We're talking with Adrian Trevis about what's happening with wolves. Hundreds of them have been slaughtered, shot down, hunted by packs of dogs, hunted from the air, hunted by snowmobile, by hunters who seemingly were just chomping at the bit for a chance to kill a wolf. Within days of the delisting happening, they were had been culled and shot, and it's just amazing how much bloodlust there is when it comes to wolves. The former head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a statement in one of the news articles last week. He said, "I've been around a long time. I have never seen such an attack on wolves." So what's the big push? Where's it coming from in D.C. to get them unlisted, delisted, I should say? And what does the future hold? It gets confusing, the overlap of management of wolves. Sometimes it's federal, sometimes it's by states. We know how the states are going to react. We've seen the evidence and just heard the examples from Adrian. And when we come back, we're going to get into that and how the regulation works and where it should head in the future right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Adrian Trevis, it seems to me that getting wolves delisted and endangered species taken off the list, that happens in Washington. A lot of people have to go along with it. Seems like it's kind of a heavy lift. Where's the pressure come from to get more than one administration to go along with something like this?
Yeah, that's a good question, George. Several administrations, Democratic and Republican, have tried to remove wolves from the endangered species list. And, you know, from one perspective, that makes sense because species put on the list were not intended to be there forever. On the other hand, they have to be secure once they're removed from the list. And wolves have only recolonized about 15% of the original range. They used to cover parts of 44 states. So, and as you pointed out in the trailer, the states are not managing to preserve those populations, with Idaho declaring they wanted to reduce their population by 90%, and Wyoming something similar. So that sort of violates the spirit of the Endangered Species Act if the federal government delists them and then states decimate them. Also, they're doing it in ways that are extremely risky. They could cause a complete population crash. So where's the pressure coming from? Political interest groups, narrow interest groups. We need those of us who support wolves on the landscape and across more of their historic range, we need the presidential administration to stand up for the best available science. The amazing thing that happened in 2019 and 2020 when the Trump administration removed wolves from the endangered species list is that they completely ignored that 4 out of 5 of their scientific peer reviewers found major shortcomings, huge problems with their proposal. And even the 5th peer reviewer was highly critical. So in essence, the Trump administration ignored the best available science, which they're required to follow under the Endangered Species Act. Trump administration ignored it, and then the Biden administration decided not to reverse the Trump decision. And so there's a problem there too. We have some nice words coming out of Department of Interior from Secretary Deb Haaland about the value of wolves, cultural and ecological value, but that needs to be followed by action. I don't know if that answers your question, George.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Secretary Haaland puts out this statement and position paper that is reprinted in multiple media places around the country a week or so ago. It talks tough. Oh, boy, you better watch out. You better not do this to wolves or else we might do something. And then she doesn't. I mean, you know.
Yeah. So she's still able to do emergency relisting for the wolves in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. Time will tell if she will. There's a lot of groups. Several hundred tribal governments have appealed to her. Hundreds of nonprofits, environmental nonprofit groups around the country have appealed to her. Scientists, I'm part of a scientist sign-on letter encouraging emergency relisting. So we stop these states from basically pillaging the legacy for current and future generations. So all of us have to speak up whenever we're talking to our lawmakers and tell them what our values are. I think that's the only way we can move forward.
Can you help me sort this out? So there was a federal judge that issued a ruling 10 or so days ago that gave protections back to gray wolves, but only in parts of the country. There's a, you know, some places, parts of it are controlled by the state. Some places it's controlled by the feds. Can you help us sort that out? Which one is which?
Yeah, sure. It's confusing. So the federal judge 10 days ago put wolves in 44 states back on the endangered species list. So that includes the wolves of Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, part of Washington, part of Oregon, and California and Colorado. The wolves that are not affected by that decision 10 days ago are the wolves in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and the eastern portions of Oregon, Washington. And that's because those wolves were removed from federal protections of the Endangered Species Act back in 2011 by a congressional budget rider. For those in your audience who don't know what a budget rider is, I had to look this up too at the time. It's turned out to be, I think, approximately two sentences put into the omnibus budget bill that Congress has to pass. And it had no financial repercussions at all. It was just two or three sentences saying that the wolves in the Northern Rockies were removed from the list and there could be no judicial review of that decision by Congress.
Wow. That's pretty sneaky.
Oh. Yeah, that's how Congress works.
All right, so the judge reinstated protections. The Secretary of the Interior is hinting that she might take action if she needs to. What's likely to happen, do you think? And how, of the populations that were shot up and killed, what kind of perilous spot are they in? Are they okay, or is it has irrevocable damage been done?
Yeah, let me start with that question first. It is very hard to predict what's going to happen in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, even if the killing moves ahead. And the reason it's really hard for scientists to predict is that the methods for counting wolves are quite crude. They have what we call wide bounds of uncertainty, which is basically what it sounds like, huge uncertainty about how many wolves are actually out on the landscape. And the reporting of the killing of wolves isn't always accurate. As I was saying, in Wisconsin, there's a lot of illegal killing that goes on that isn't detected by the state agencies unless the wolf had a collar and the poachers didn't destroy that collar. So we've got a lot of uncertainty about what's going on. And unless the states collect good information on reproduction by wolf packs, that is the number of pups born and that survive till, say, late fall, until we get those sorts of data, we're not going to know how badly or how safely the wolf populations are persisting over time. Idaho claims that its wolf population is the same as last year, despite the heavy death toll it's already inflicted on its wolf population. I'm listening to a number of experts in the region, experts in the field of wolf population dynamics, and they're extremely skeptical of Idaho's claims. So uncertainty for scientists leads them to be very cautious in their predictions. It should also lead state agencies to be extremely cautious in their management and their hunting quotas, just by the legal principle of the public trust, but also common sense. If Idaho doesn't want the federal government to step in, it really needs to control the killing and make sure that they don't drop the population so severely as they're planning. Now, that's my opinion, my value judgment. Obviously, they have different values. So the first part of your question was looking into the crystal ball, what is the federal government going to do? And I really don't know. Looking at the court decision from 10 days ago, the judge sided with the plaintiffs on, I think it was 6 out of 7 of the plaintiffs' complaints about the Trump administration delisting. So it would be really hard to appeal that decision and overturn all 6 of those reasons for putting wolves back on the list. So I would guess the Biden administration does not decide to appeal that decision. What will Secretary Holland put the wolves of Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana back on the endangered species list under emergency relisting rules of the Endangered Species Act? That's a really good question. If I were a betting man, I'd say maybe 50-50 odds, because there's likely a political backlash against the Biden administration, and so their feet are being held to the fire by those Western states and conservative groups that sort of see wolves as part of the culture war against the liberals.
Can you describe, or if you know, what happens to an individual wolf pack when key members are shot and killed, when dogs scatter them all, and when the alpha male is killed, when the premier mom is killed, or a couple of members of it? What happens to them? How do they react? I ask it in this context. Here in the West, in Nevada, we have these wild horses that are all over the place. They do these roundups. They'll let a couple of horses out. They completely destroy the bands, the family structures. And the horses sometimes go into reproductive overdrive. So the idea of we don't want more horses, it's reverse. The same thing is kind of true for coyotes, and we can talk about that. You kill coyotes, they produce more coyotes. And now we have coyotes everywhere. What happens to wolves when this happens?
Yeah, I think what you're describing for coyotes is probably the case. It may be the case sometimes for wolves. So, first, a caveat, which is that we don't have a ton of scientific data about individual behavior of wolves, especially after wolf packs are subjected to lethal management. We just don't know how the individuals behave and how their ecology changes. So that's a gap in our knowledge, and we tend to fill it with data on the population, which is not the same. We just need to fo we sh we should be focusing on packs as families and teams to understand the effects of lethal management. But there is research that suggests that if you kill a few members of the pack, it sometimes will disband. At other times, you can actually form two packs out of where one was, which is the dynamic you were just alluding to, George, where you're actually ending up with more wolf packs or more coyote packs, and they're going to reproduce at twice the speed potentially. And then the third outcome is that the smaller pack is going to have more. It's going to stay where it is. It's going to stay a cohesive unit. Or cohesive family, but it's not going to be as effective in defense of its territory, not as effective in hunting, which means that the individual wolves may go hungry and start looking for a much more predictable, easy to catch food source. Now, the most predictable food source on the landscape is livestock, right? Because in my part of the country, they're on fenced pastures, which don't move, obviously. So they're very predictable. And even out west, in your part of the country where public grazing lands are used, even those, it's pretty predictable where the livestock are going to be and when, especially if you can travel for hundreds of square miles like a wolf pack can. So these smaller teams of wolves that are not functioning as well because some of their teammates got killed, they're going to start looking for the more predictable food. And what Dr. Francisco Santiago Avila found in the best science ever done on this subject in the U.S., studying the Michigan Lethal Control Program, is he found that killing one or two or even up to seven wolves in a pack actually tripled the risk for cattle in neighboring townships. And his results have just been replicated in France by Dr. Oksana Grant in nine different regions of France where they've been killing wolves to protect sheep and cattle. Same thing happened. In most cases, it didn't improve the safety of livestock. Sometimes it exacerbated the problem, and you got more livestock losses after killing wolves.
Do you know if wolves mourn? I think I've read something to the effect. I guess maybe the people, the observers, were guessing, but somebody dies in their family, they react.
I do not know that, but I would not be surprised. These are intelligent animals capable of strong emotional bonds and long-lasting social bonds in these families. So it's kind of a no-brainer to imagine that they mourn the loss of their family members just like we do.
In the West, we still have these obscene coyote killing contests where there's a prize put up and it's fun for the whole family to go out and see how many coyotes you can kill. I saw just last week, it's on Twitter, this woman and her dad, father-daughter, coyote killing contest. Gosh, Dad, we killed 12. It was just great. I just don't get it. I don't get that. Even if you hate coyotes, by doing this, you produce more coyotes. That coyotes now are everywhere, largely in response to people trying to wipe them out. Reaction?
Yeah, there's no scientific justification for this coyote killing contest. It doesn't do anything good. So some people enjoy this. And I just want to remind your listeners that the good reputation of hunting in the United States and Canada comes from the early part of the 20th century when there were too many commercial hunters, killing hundreds of waterfowl, killing every deer they could see to sell the meat, to sell for the food markets. And what happened was folks like Teddy Roosevelt, Aldo Leopold, they worked super hard to turn hunting into a regulated event, regulation, where hunters were limited. Their bag limit was often just one animal, and there was no commercial sale of the meat. That regulation is starting to be lost in things like coyote killing contests. So hunters are losing their good reputation by allowing these sorts of events to take place. It's un-American, violates the public trust, and it's tarnishing the reputation of hunting as a conservation method. Hunting is no longer a conservation method in the USA, in my opinion.
A lot of work and planning went into, with the states and the feds, different agencies working on trying to manage wolf populations. That kind of goes out the window when you just allow wholesale slaughter like this, doesn't it? I mean, a lot of work and money gets wasted.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, taxpayers paid for all that recovery, all the monitoring. They paid for the federal grants to states to manage and monitor wolves. And after delisting, the states are just killing them off, often for very low permit fees. So, yeah, I call that a waste.
We're talking with Adrian Trevis about wolves, coyotes, and other large carnivores. He works with a center, a lab that has been studying alternative ways instead of shooting them down or sending packs of dogs after carnivores like that, big predators. There are other methods that could work, and we're going to talk about that a little bit on the way on the other side, and then take some of your calls as well. We're talking with Adrian Trevis of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab and the University of Wisconsin Madison about wolves and other species that are in trouble, that we humans just want to take shots at and get rid of them. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, hear more about his center, his lab, how you can help, and then open up the phone lines, get some of your calls and questions and comments here on Coast to Coast AM. Adrian, you read these articles, as I do, about scientists who say that a mass extinction event is underway now, that species are disappearing. A lot of them are already gone, that those that remain are highly stressed. I have an example of bears here in Nevada. There was a story last week about the bears around Lake Tahoe. You know, there were terrible wildfires that wiped out habitat and killed bears and scattered the rest of them. Then the bears emerged from the fire season. The climate has changed to the point where they don't hibernate. So they're out there right now looking for food when they normally, if the weather wasn't so different, they'd still be hibernating instead of being out going through garbage cans. So then more of them get killed, and then hunting season doesn't take a break. There are a lot of species like that, and I imagine you study a lot of them at this your carnivore center there, lab. It just is hard to believe that at a time like this, when the planet has so many problems and so many species are under duress, that we'd be going out to shoot out of our way to kill bears, wolves, coyotes. Just humans can be clueless at times.
Yeah, at the Carver Coexistence Lab, we study cheetahs and tigers, lions, other endangered carnivores around the world, and right here in our own country, the red wolf that's critically endangered, found only in North Carolina, across nowhere else in the world. And it's down to 8 individuals, and that's because of illegal killing. And we've been warning the federal government about illegal killing for 6 years now, and not getting a lot of traction. So yeah, it's kind of remarkable that we're facing this sixth mass extinction caused by humans. It's mainly because of habitat transformations, but also overkilling, and now climate change is adding on top of it. And if we want to stop this extinction, we have to stop our old practices and old habits. We probably have to reel back hunting, in my opinion, to only to control the overabundant populations like white-tailed deer. Every other kind of hunting is a recreation we can't afford, a luxury we can't afford. It's causing too much damage for the societal benefits, which are sparse anyway.
Hunting is big money, though. You know, they have this this organization that meets here in Las Vegas. Seems like they have a convention every year, and they raffle off these great hunts where you can go kill five different animals. It'll cost you $80,000. It's big business. I mean, dentists and professionals pay big money just to go somewhere to shoot something.
Sure. Some private companies are making a lot of money that way with trophy hunting, safari hunting, that kind of thing. But you know, the majority of funding for wildlife agencies doesn't come from hunting and angling anymore. It comes from other sources of funding. And all those people who buy firearms for home defense, most people never go hunting, and yet the funding goes to wildlife agencies, and somehow hunters get the credit for that.
Your lab, the Carnivore Coexistence Lab, which sounds like it's doing great work, what kind of funding do you get? How do you get along, and do you need more?
Well, we always need more, of course.
Sure.
It's an easy one, right? We sometimes get our funding from government, sometimes from private foundations. Most recently, National Geographic supported us to study range riders. That's a form of a non-lethal cowboy. You can think of them in the Canadian Rockies. We studied low-stress livestock handling by men and women on horseback, watching cattle on public lands, in habitat with grizzly bears, wolves, cougars, coyotes, and black bears. And those range riders were effective, and no cattle were injured or killed. No carnivores were injured or killed. So that's the sort of experiment that we do. We did it as a randomized controlled trial, what we call the gold standard in science, and funded by private sources, National Geographic in that case. Another project we did was funded by the Bad River Tribe of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. So a tribal government helped finance that with help from the federal government. And we studied fox lights, which is a random light device triggered at night, supposed to look like people waving a flashlight around, and goes off at random intervals for nighttime protection of cattle and smaller stock. And we tried something called fladry. That's a Polish word for hanging, flagging from fence lines at narrow intervals. And we spaced it for coyotes, and during that time had no coyote attacks or injuries of livestock. That's research by Abby Fergus, who works for the Bad River Tribal Natural Resource Agency. And the first project I mentioned was research by Naomi Lauchauarn in the Canadian Rockies, working in close collaboration with Joe Englehart on low-stress livestock handling.
Thanks for that information. I'm going to take a couple of calls. We'll start west of the Rockies. Jack in Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Jack. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, I called because I raised wolf hybrids for 30 years.
What kind? What's the hybrid? What was it? Gray wolves mixed with dogs or what?
Well, the original female was 50% red wolf, 25% gray wolf, 25% Alaskan hybrid.
You have a question for Adrian?
No, I ain't got a question, but I got answers.
Adrian, what do you think about wolf hybrids with dogs? Is that a good idea to mix the two?
I'm really not an expert on that topic. In Wisconsin, the practice of breeding them was made illegal because there were too many instances of threats to human safety from
Right.
wolf-dog hybrids that got away from their enclosures. But I'm not an expert on the topic.
Jack, thank you for the call. Appreciate your call in and let us know you were listening. We're going to the wild card line, Mary in New Jersey. Hi, Mary. You're on with Adrian Trevis.
Every time I hear these stories, I get so sad. It makes me cry. And I just want to switch to the Bible. There was 8 people saved all the animals on the ark. God says he hated Esau, who was a hunter. And I found out that Esau is related to King Herod, who's a cold-blooded killer. So that's what I think of hunting when it's not necessary.
Well, thank you for sharing your opinion. We're going to go to David in Columbus, Ohio, on the wild card line. Hi, David. You're on with Adrian Trevis.
Yes, sir. I'm 76 years old. I hate to ask stupid questions, but I got to know. When you're in the wild and you encounter wolves, are they somehow afraid of us, or are we just something else to eat?
That's not a stupid question at all, David.
No.
The risk to people from wolves is so small that scientists studying this couldn't even estimate it. So what happens is 99% of the time wolves are going to run away from people long before the people even know they're there, right? They're going to hear us coming, and they're going to run off. But every once in a while, maybe 1% of encounters, you do see a glimpse of that wolf, and it'll stop and look. And a couple things happen there. Wolves, like dogs, will look us in the eye often. They're trying to read what we're going to do. They're going to try to predict what we're doing by looking at our eyes. And some people who are used to animals never looking at our eyes and running away from us, they interpret a wolf looking at our eyes as if it's somehow aggressive or bold or not afraid of us. But it's just part of the behavior of the wolf that they look at the eyes of the individuals with which they interact, just like our dogs look at our eyes. Actually, dogs do it more than wolves, but it's a similar behavior.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. We're going to Patrick in Wind River, Wyoming. Hi, Patrick. You're here to talk about wolves?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind?
Hello. Hi. I was going to say, I hear all these ranchers, getting up all up in arms about, livestock being killed by wolves. I'm like, well, but they're not, looking at, the whole picture, the environment, these extreme weather events killing livestock. Because you just now had, in 2019, the bomb cyclone, hit, Colorado and Nebraska, had, ice tsunamis wiping out whole herds, Yeah, that's just my little insight, but I'm a big fan of the show. Thanks.
I think, Adrian, you mentioned that weather was way more of an impact than wolves do on livestock.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Patrick. Weather, disease, and accidents are the big killers, and predators of all sorts are usually less than 1% of all livestock losses. And that's even including free-running dogs included in the predator category. So it's not that I don't have sympathy. It's that the complaints are exaggerated. And if we really wanted to help farmers, owners of domestic animals, especially owners of farm animals, we would be helping them reduce disease and weather and accident deaths.
We're going to go to Rob, who is trucking in Wisconsin. They're right in your neck of the woods, Adrian. Rob, what's on your mind?
Hey, George and Adrian. Thank you so much. I'm a hunter, and I agree with everything Adrian says, but to me, and most hunters that I know, trophy hunting and illegal hunting, that's poaching. You don't hunt for trophies. You hunt to put food on the table. So it seems to me that blaming the hunters is kind of misguided when you want to take care of the illegal actions that are taking place. But also, why do you not go after the lobbyists as far as the insurance companies, stuff like that, and the government to stop this? Because it seems to me like that's what's promoting these killing of the wolves. So why are we not going after that? And like they did with the deer, I mean, that's the big reason why there's so many deer tags available in most states is because the insurance companies are paying out big money for deer accidents in cars. Isn't it the same principle behind the wolf killings?
I don't know. I would say, first of all, that nobody's hunting wolves to eat them, right? But Adrian, do you have any thoughts about this? The insurance companies pressuring hunters to have more tags? I was unaware of that.
Sorry, the caller was breaking up just a little bit, but so I'm going to throw out some statistics. I believe the caller was very familiar with it. I'm sorry, I missed your name. I got stuck on the trucking. I guess you're calling while you're driving?
His name is Rob. Yeah, he's driving.
Rob. Okay, Rob, I'm with you on a number of the points you made. You know, in the last 30 years, the deer population in Wisconsin just went steadily up and up and up. So if the insurance companies are doing anything to reduce deer vehicle collisions, well, it isn't working. So I'm not really sure where that argument comes from. But yeah, I agree with you. We really need to crack down on illegal killing. And for years, we've been talking about that. From 2016 to 2020, all we talked about was the government cracking down on poaching, on illegal killing. In 2022, with Dr. Francisco Santiago Avila, we showed that most of the wolf poaching is occurring during the bear hunting season, the deer hunting season, and the bear hound training seasons in Wisconsin. So we're forced to conclude that the small percentage of poachers are hiding. They're using as cover the law-abiding hunting community out there. And basically, we need the hunting community to self-police and get these bad actors out of the business. We need the state agency to revoke their hunting licenses and in some cases prosecute. Otherwise, we're not going to get a handle on this law-breaking. So I'm with you, Rob. I appreciate you calling in.
Thanks, Rob. And is there, I don't know if there's statistics available, but are there prosecutions of poachers? Is it, I guess it happens once in a while, but is it common?
Yeah, exactly. It happens once in a while. And the reason it's rare is that the agencies aren't cracking down. They often don't know how to detect and measure poaching. They don't crack down even when they have pretty solid evidence. And part of the problem here is with the U.S. Department of Justice. So the federal Department of Justice had a policy called the McKittrick policy, where they would not prosecute for killing wolves and other endangered species unless there was just solid bulletproof, sorry, no pun intended, solid evidence that the perpetrators knew they were killing endangered species.
Oh,
turns out that was a misunderstanding of the Endangered Species Act, but the effect of the policy has been that poachers have not been prosecuted, even though poaching is the major cause of wolf mortality in every U.S. population that's been studied in the lower 48.
Can you give us a quick encapsulation about grizzlies? I know you deal with grizzlies as well. Are they in trouble or are they okay? Same kind of issues pop up with grizzlies, though, right? They're a danger to livestock. They need to be shot.
That's right. Plus, they can damage orchards. They can tear up your garbage, obviously. But they're a much more popular species than wolves in attitude surveys. You know, the vast majority of respondents say they love grizzlies. They want them on the landscape, maybe not damaging their property, but nobody wants to eradicate the grizzlies. There are some of the same public policy debates going on about whether grizzlies should be listed on the Endangered Species Act, which they are currently, and whether they should be delisted and hunted by the states that contain those. Grizzlies used to range across a much broader area. They're largely restricted to the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and the northwest part of the U.S. So they are very restricted geographically. Therefore, there are not many grizzlies. A study by Gabriel Carnes showed that most experts believe the grizzlies should be under the endangered species list, that they're not out of the woods yet.
Seems like, Adrian, that a lot of what we talked about tonight, if the public out there, if our audience wants to fix things, they have to get involved with it. They have to let members of Congress know, their elected officials. They have to let the Department of Justice know that that poachers need to be prosecuted. Then the hunters who care about the environment, who care about these species, who play by the rules, need to step up to the plate and police this themselves.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we have to get involved, right? We have to fight for our democracy every year. So you can Google who your lawmakers are and give them a call, write them an email, tell them what you feel about all of these topics. And if I could leave, you know, your audience with one lasting recommendation, it's that we need our public policy to be based on evidence and facts, not based on opinion and not based on values purely, because right now there's a clash of values in every it seems like every public policy issue around the country, there's a clash of values, which is pitting one American against another. We need to get beyond that and start balancing our values and the diversity of values in our country against facts and evidence and what our children and grandchildren would like to see.
And we have a link to your work on our website, but are they going to find the papers that you've written about wolves and grizzlies and things like that on that site?
Yes, or go to the, okay. Post them all free of charge, no paywall.
Professor Adrian Trevis, thanks so much for being here. I hope you stay in touch, and if we could ever help get the word out about wolves or other species, we're glad to do it.
Thank you so much, George. It was a pleasure.
Thanks very much. All right, we take a break now. When we come back, Robert Guffey, author of Camellio, take us in an entirely different direction.